Tony Robbins. What else can you really say about Tony Robbins? He's one of the most famous coaches and speakers ever. He's built a massive business and community around him. We talk about his book, Money, Master the Game, Tech Investing, Family, Relationships, Sex, Coaching, Service, and a lot more. All right, here's Tony. What's the relationship between money and happiness, between money and the quality of relationships? Talk a little bit about that.
It's a great question. But the research has shown that once you get above $65,000 in this country of income, your happiness factor does not go proportionally with your economics. In fact, it doesn't double when you double your income, not even close. It goes up about 7% from that level, so say $65,000 to $130,000. But you know, there's some new research that just came out in the last about year and a half, and they've done it based on new sensors where they can literally sense the changes in the biochemistry of the hormones in your mouth, in your saliva, as you're experiencing it. And they found something very interesting that I thought was really kind of cool. They found it doesn't matter how much money you earn. That will not change your level of happiness beyond the $65,000, $120,000. It'll do it, but it'll do it at a minor level. But what really determines your happiness is how you spend money does play a role. If you spend money for things, your happiness is very transitory, right? It doesn't really last. But if you spend money on something that's an experience, there's this difference between the experiencing self and the you know, kind of the remembering self. We have two different selves. You have the experience, and then you have the memory of it. And the memory of it is what you judge things by. And they say, you know, that if you go for experiences, they tend to give you deeper memories, and you might go back to that over and over again and get pleasure from it for years to come. Anytime somebody brings up Fiji, oh, yeah, I went to this trip to Fiji. Oh, my God, it was the most amazing thing. And so that experience does more than things, per se. But what really was interesting, even more so to me, and true in my experience, is that one of the things that gave the greatest level of value, sounds corny, but it's true, and that was giving money away. Giving it to strangers lit people up much more than anything that they could actually get for themselves, and giving it to people you loved was extraordinary. Now, how you gave it, if you feel like you had to give it, you got no joy. If you felt it was an expectation, people got no joy. In fact, it was a negative. But if you were able to create what I call a jackpot, which I love doing, I love taking one of my executives and calling him up on Christmas Eve night and saying, dude, I'm so sorry. We got this meeting. It's a legal issue. You're the only one who can help me. I promise it's just an hour. Meet me, you know, here at the hotel at, you know, 11 or at 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock. And he comes at 4 o'clock. And of course, you know, all year he's been talking about this brand new Corvette that has not, there's no one, you can't get one yet. There's only one in California. People want a $30,000, you know, spiff on top of the retail in order to buy their place. And so I've arranged it. I bought it. It's Christmas Eve. That's where I'm going to deliver it. Perfect timing. He comes to the hotel. I'm out front in front of this Hyatt hotel. And I said, I'm so sorry. We're in La Jolla. I said, come on in. And as we start to walk in, right in front of the doors is this white on white, brand new style Corvette. And he goes, oh my God, that's the car. I said, what car? He goes, that's the car I've been dreaming about. I said, what are you talking about? Oh my God. And he starts telling me for 5 minutes, every detail of the car. And the window's open and the door's open. So I open the door. I said, why don't you get in? He goes, I can't get in somebody's car. I said, no one's going to know. He goes, no. I said, yes, you can. I hand him the keys. I mean, that shit, I live for those things. I do those. There's legends at my companies about these types of experiences, because nothing gives me more joy than to be able to make something like that happen for somebody and have somebody just be shocked. It's not just like you give them a bonus, or you can take the time to figure out what people need and want and deliver it. But it can be done with $10. I mean, in the book, I give you all these research of how people spend 10 bucks and they develop greater happiness because they spend it in a way that actually was beyond themselves. I really believe the secret to living is giving, as corny as it may sound. I had an experience, I remember vividly when I was struggling and I was 19 years old, and you know, you're 19, you think everything's going to happen, you know, in no time, and you're working your guts out, and I'm like, what's wrong? You know, since then I've kind of realized that most people overestimate what they can do in a year and they underestimate what they can do in a decade or two or three. But at the time I was totally frustrated, and I was in the middle of the night, I'm driving my old Volkswagen down this freeway in the East Los Angeles area, San Gabriel Valley, and at midnight I pull over on the freeway, and I was so emotional, so angry, and I just had pulled over and had tears coming out of me, and I just wrote on a journal page. I still have the journal, a whole page where I just wrote, the secret to living is giving. And it just, like, I realized I was so focused on doing and making it happen, and why wasn't I getting and achieving? And I was like, fuck, you are not giving enough. And I, my own personal belief is, I mean, Anybody can get rich. Can you stay rich? Can you develop real wealth, mental, emotional, spiritual, and financial? And the only way to do that is do more for other people than anybody else on earth is doing. If you can find a way to add more value than anybody else, then you'll never have to worry about anything, least of all economics. Right? And I really think you're going to have a life that's meaningful, because happiness may come and go, but a life of meaning, you can have shit happen and still have a meaningful life. Being, you know, joyous and happy every moment, I think it's bullshit. Nobody's like that all the time. But meaningfulness, feeling like life matters, that leads to deeper levels of fulfillment than just mere happiness.
And so let's go. You're saying you're 19, you're struggling, you're having this moment. How did you figure out that this was your way of giving to the world? How did Tony Robbins become Tony Robbins?
Well, gosh, I was always, you know, I was always obsessed with wanting to know the answer to things. Even when I was a little kid, I was like, when I was in the fifth grade, I read the entire science book, you know, during the weekends. I had four different fathers. One of my fathers wanted to be an actor, and he used to drive out to the desert with a bunch of people trying to make a film that never happened. But I hated being stuck in the car, so I would read the entire science book, took all the tests. So the teacher had to figure out what to do with me. So he sent me to the library, and I would do studies on light or Mars and how it functions. So I've always obsessed and crazy that way. But when I was in, I guess, in junior high school, I started. High school, it just took off like crazy. I want to know the answer to how to make life better. And I wanted it initially for myself. I was a little fat kid, believe it or not. I was 5'1" my sophomore year in high school. I'm now 6'7". You know, I grew 10 inches in a year. People say, you know, how'd that happen? I say personal growth. But I actually had a tumor in my brain that shot this growth hormone through my body. So that's what happened. I didn't find out until about 10 years later. But long story short, I became obsessed with, I figured out how to lose weight. And all of a sudden, you know, girls responded to me. And my buddies were like, how do you do that? I helped them. And I began to recognize this pattern, which was, wow, if I could have the answer, I could light people up. And when I light people up, I'd get all this love. So I was a love bug. And I thought, okay, don't ask for it. Give, give, give. And so my goal was to read a book a day. I didn't quite do that, but I read 700 books in the area of human development and psychology and physiology and philosophy, anything I thought could make life better. But what I did besides read is I really tried to apply at least one action out of every book I read. So what am I going to do with this? And that developed a great, simple discipline for me. And most people read and they let their learning lead to knowledge. I let my learning lead to action. And I really believe that was the difference in my life. And so that became my mantra. Like, what am I going to do with this? How can I apply this? And one thing led to another. So I became in high school Mr. Solution. You have a problem, I got a solution, especially if you're a girl. I was extra motivated in that area. And then I went to work for a man named Jim Rohn, who was a personal development speaker when I was 17. And I became the top guy in his company because I was obsessed with changing people's lives. And people would sit down with me and I would go do a talk. And I found out the best speaker in his entire organization of 1,000 people would speak on average 3 times a month. And everybody like bowed to this guy. And I'm not a bowing kind of guy. So I went up to this guy. And I was a brat. I just went up to him. I was 19. And I said, remember my name because I will dwarf you within 6 months. And this guy looked at me like I was insane. And I just said, you know why? I said, because you have no work ethic. I said, you're really talented. And that's all you have. And I said, I'll develop your talent. I have twice your worth, maybe 10 times. I said, you mark it. You mark this day. It's the day you're going down. And everybody like watched this. I did it publicly. I don't recommend this, but it was kind of my personality as a kid. I was still proving myself till I own myself. And so I went out.
Where did that come from? Were you always competitive? Or like, what do you think as a kid, you know, where did that come from?
I was always little, and I just, something inside me never would take shit from anybody. But unfortunately, like in high school, you know, my first day in high school, the nose guard and the football team and I are both interested in the, you know, senior high cheerleader, song leader. I'm obviously no competition for him, but somehow I got this belief that I can make her laugh, so I'll get her.
And were your parents also thinking of this way? How did they support this?
No. My father that was a underground garage parking lot guy that used to take people's tickets all day long and came home as alcoholic, not a mean alcoholic. My mom was an extreme alcoholic and kind of physically abusive. So I developed resourcefulness at an early age to take care of them. But I also, you know, when I would go to school, maybe because I took shit at home. I mean, I'm just actually realizing this. When I went to school, I wasn't going to take it from anybody. So this guy, like, poured chocolate milk, you know, told me things. I told him to F off. And then I ran. Of course, I was too slow. And he just beat the shit out of me. And I get up and curse him out again. Poured chocolate milk on me, and then I ended up taking the girl to the homecoming dance. So I don't know, something inside of me just wouldn't let go. And then eventually, you know, I grew into myself physically, mentally, and emotionally, and spiritually. But having answers, I mean, having answers was what drove me. And when I had those answers, and eventually I got to, when I was in my early, what was I, 21, I got to experience neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP, how to use language to change the nervous system. And similarly there, you know, I just basically was a challenge-oriented person. It's like, you know, I went on national radio in Canada. I got on a radio show because I was doing my first little seminar. And I challenged the psychiatrist who called me up and said I was a liar and a charlatan because I said I could wipe out a phobia in less than 15 minutes. And he said, and I worked on this woman for 7 years. And I said, great. You know, I said, you're a scientist, aren't you? He said, of course I'm a scientist. I said, then have you ever met me? And he said, no. I said, have you ever met any of my clients? He said, no. I said, you never met me, you never met my clients, and you're calling me a liar on national radio. And I said, you're a scientist. I said, the scientist, what you're really stating is your hypothesis. Your hypothesis is I'm a liar and a charlatan. So if you're going to test your hypothesis, if you're a real scientist, come next week for the Holiday Inn on Thursday night at 7:30. I'm doing a free guest event, and bring me your patient. Because I can't do that. I said, sure you can. Either that or apologize. And I was just confronted. And so the good news of that style of communication I had at that stage of my life was I put him in a box and he had to come. He was on radio, lose face. And this woman he treated for 7 years had a snake phobia. And 15 minutes later, I wrapped a snake around her. And everybody in the room was just like, oh, my God. And then I took a woman who hadn't had an orgasm in 10 years and gave an orgasm without touching her. And then I had, then the media jumped on. Then I had the firewalk. And all those things grew. And then I turned to sports. I turned around, you know, I'm old enough to be around since the 1984 Olympics. When I was just 23 years old, I worked with a swimmer at that point, Michael Bryan, who wasn't supposed to make the team, and he won the 1500 freestyle. And then next thing I know is, you know, I got a chance to work with Mother Teresa. And then, you know, I went overseas to start working in England. I turned around Sheffield United. They lost, you know, 8 games in a row. And after I worked with them, the PBS followed me. They won 4 games in a row. And they go, maybe you should work with the Queen. And the next thing I know, I'm working with Bill Clinton. And you know, Nelson Mandela, and just expanded. And then I built up along the way. I developed a knack for building companies. And so now we do $5 billion a year in annual sales. And I've got, you know, 12 core companies that I'm directly partner involved in. And then I've got, you know, a little more than 27, 28, I guess, that are small ventures that I've just put my capital into.
It's crazy to think that this is all before the days of social media, and even email, you know,
I would have died for that. I'm old enough to remember going to the library. That's how ancient I am, baby. I used to listen to a Walkman bigger than your head.
That's funny. So, I mean, a lot of people credit you with kind of, you know, inventing or really putting CEO coaching, life coaching on the map. Where do you see the future of life coaching and personal coaching going?
Personally, I hate the term life coaching, and I hate life coaches. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but I'll tell you why. Before I started, no one was using that as a term of art outside of sports. I was, at the beginning of my career, I wasn't a motivator, and people were calling me that because they go in a room, and in those days, 1,000 people, these days, 10,000, 30,000 people, and they see these people having the time of their life, and it's like a rock and roll concert, so we must be motivating them. But no, it's just like, why should you be bored while you're learning? Why not make it pure entertainment while you're being empowered and while you're being educated? Why settle? You know, I take people on a 50-hour journey in a weekend where most people won't sit for a 3-hour movie someone gave $300 million to make, right? It's just like, when you know how to put people where all their needs are being met, time disappears. So from a perspective of, you know, how do you shift all that? My focus has been, look, if you want to be able to put somebody in a place where they're going to be changed, then you should put yourself on the line. And I thought to myself, I'm not a motivator. I'm really a strategist. But at the base level, what model can I relate to that's helped my life? And as an athlete, I had some coaches that were nowhere near as good an athlete as I was, but they increased my performance massively because I'm in the forest, they're outside the forest, they could see it. And I thought, that's my model. I don't think I'm better than anybody. I'm a coach. And that's what I started using. And I did it for about 8 or 9 years. And around, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years into it, I'd worked with President Clinton, and I was on Larry King. And Larry King was interviewing me about it. And he was saying, you know, what is this coach thing? You're not a coach. You're not, you know, you don't run a sports team. I know you work with some sports teams. But I was just about to give it up. And then suddenly everybody became a coach, right? Therapists were coaches, financial coaches, now the term of art. What I hate about it was mine was based on results. You pay me only if I produce the result. If I don't eliminate that phobia, you pay me nothing, right? And what it became was anybody going to some class that somebody made up, giving them a certificate, and now, I mean, it's a bastardized industry because there really isn't a standard for it. So I think there's lots of growth for it because, listen, being able to share your advice and have someone pay you for it is something that's very attractive. You can do it from anywhere. It's easy. And unfortunately, with the web, it's easy for people to market themselves. Whether they'll be successful or not is another question. Whether they'll serve the client or not is another question. So I'm not a big fan of an industry that's a monster I kind of helped give birth to, but I'm a very big fan for those people that add more value than anybody else. I'm a giant fan for the few people, the small number of people that when those people are done, they go, oh my God, I got a million times more than what I paid for this and my time and my energy and my money.
What do you do when you have this feeling that you're coaching someone else and you don't know if they have this hunger and kind of your success is predicated upon them taking their lives into their own hands? What's the psychology there? And then talk more about hunger. You know, how much of it is born? How much of it can be developed? How do you assess it when you meet someone right away? You know, talk about hunger.
Sure, I'm happy to. When it comes to hunger, first of all, when you meet somebody, I mean, you know if somebody's hungry. I mean, you can feel there's a sense of drive. It's visceral. I mean, it's not just purely intellectual. You know, I always tell people, you don't have to guess who I am. Don't watch my lips moving. Anybody can make their lips move anyway. Watch how my feet have moved for 3.5 decades.
But can't you just show the part?
Well, sure you can. You can go to an interview and do it, but through time, you're not going to be able to. It shows itself. But more importantly, how do you find it if you don't have it? Because, you know, are you born with it? I don't know. Some people, maybe they are. You see some children that are more driven when they're just literally an infant, more driven to, you know, figure things out, more curious. I think there certainly is a genetic element, but it certainly can be nurtured. And the best way to nurture hunger, in my experience, is, you know, it comes from inspiration or desperation. I mean, if you've got a difficult enough life, you've got a hunger to change things. There's no question. I think in the beginning of my life, there's no question I was driven. In the very beginning, the hunger is like, I wanted to get out of this mess. But that won't keep you growing. The only keep you growing is a hunger to serve something more than yourself. If it's just meeting your own needs, you know, I always tell people motive does matter. There's nothing wrong with wanting to meet your own needs. Life supports whatever supports more of life. You're part of life. You'll get insights. But if you're looking, as I did, where, you know, I'm 24 years old, I get married at 25, and I suddenly have, you know, 3 children instantly, and I'm 25, and one of them is 17, and one is 11, and one is 5, and I got a little one on the way. Suddenly, you know, the world changed for me. I had to grow at a different level. Suddenly, it's like my motive was not just me, it was something greater. And then, you know, my motive became my community and then humanity. And as corny as it sounds, the larger of what you want to serve, life seems to step in and serve that as well. But you got to have something larger than yourself. And the way to find that hunger is get around where it's better and let something hit you. Hunger doesn't interrupt you. Hunger is a disturbing force. It comes because things don't, you know, they aren't the way you want. And instead of medicating yourself by toking something or taking a prescription drug or eating or going to a movie, instead of, you know, just like not wanting to feel disappointed and distracting yourself, you discipline your disappointment and you push forward and you'll find your hunger. Or if you get around, I remember years and years ago, I thought I was doing so well, and I went on this trip with my friend Peter Guber, who owns the LA Dodgers, along with Guggenheim, and he's co-owner with the Warriors NBA basketball team, and he's got 52 Academy Awards. He's one of the most creative people I know, and I was in my late 20s, early 30s, probably 30 years old, and we went on this trip with him, and I'll never forget, we're on this trip, and on the trip was all these movie executives, you know, he was the chairman of Sony at the time, Columbia and TriStar and all this stuff, and we're on this yacht, and these guys are all talking about, yeah, I made $20 million, you know, on this picture this year and things of that nature. And I remember at the time thinking, shit, I thought I was doing pretty well, making $4 million a year at 30 years old. I mean, you know, I'm doing what I love. I'm changing the world and I'm doing well economically. And then I saw their lifestyle and I felt like I was just nothing. And it wasn't about the money. It was about living life on your terms. These guys could do whatever the hell they wanted. And something inside of me said, I want that kind of freedom. But I felt like, holy shit. I'm like, that's so beyond my imagination. It's crazy. And that day I decided I didn't want a yacht because these guys had a yacht. I just didn't want that. But I did want to live my life where I would never have to say no to something I wanted to give to someone. I wanted to share. I wanted to experience. I wanted to do. And so I said, you know, someday I'm going to do this. And I'm going to do it on my terms. I'm going to do it not selling out. I'm going to do it doing what I love. I'm going to find the way. And I remember the year that I made $20 million in a year. I was like, oh, my God, it was this incredible thing. And then it was like, who gives a shit? You know, it's a cool thing. It's a little notch on your belt that you got yourself from nothing to achieve something kind of fun like that. What are you going to do with it? That's what matters. What are you going to do with your life? What are you going to make happen? And so I think your hunger, if you're always growing, hunger never goes away, because whenever you get to whatever you think is, you know, nirvana, you always discover that's total bullshit. It was just the purpose of a goal is not to get the goal. The purpose of a goal is what it makes of you to get the goal. If you got to grow and expand spiritually and mentally and emotionally and intellectually and your own psychology and your skill sets at a geometric level to achieve something, then that's a worthy goal. I think it's the same thing in a relationship. I think, you know it's the right relationship when the person in your relationship, you want to be more. You don't only want to be more, you become more of who you really are in order to be in relationship with them. That's the right relationship. Somebody that it just accepts you as who you are, that feels really nice. But I'd rather have a friend that loves me and would say, kick my ass if I'm off base, because they love me, not to try to kick my ass. I'd rather have that than somebody just accepts me the way they are, although I don't really need anybody to kick my ass, quite frankly. But I love friendships where we both are pushing each other by our example, by our creativity, by our focus on how can we do more for others than anybody else. That's the right kind of competitive nature that makes life more beautiful and meaningful.
Yeah. How do you ever worry about, I talked to Tim about this too, and a lot of high achievers, you know, listening, focused on growth so much that you don't kind of stop to smell the roses once in a while. You know, how do you think about that?
Well, I'm fortunate enough to have found the right woman in my life. So yeah. I was married for 14 years to a lady who's a great lady, but no one teaches you how to pick your partner. And she'd been married twice before me and had children for both of them. So I adopted all those kids. And that was the great gift of that relationship. And I'm not a quitter. So I stayed 14 years. The kids were all grown. And then I just said, you know what? I don't want to go into my 40s. I was 39 and go, into another decade and have my life be fulfilled by my work and my children. I want that level of intimacy to be alive as well. And there's nothing wrong with it. We're just different. So I made that decision, which at the time was the toughest decision, because I want to, I'm a guy that wants to make everybody happy, right? And I'm pretty damn good at it. And so, when you get a divorce, no one's happy. You know, she's not happy. My kids weren't happy. But I went through that phase, and thank God I did, because, then I found my wife today, my Bonnie Pearl, my sage. And I'll tell you, just the last 15 years of her have been the greatest gift of my life. And she's the balance for me, because she doesn't love me because I'm Tony Robbins. She just loves me. You know, I don't need to achieve anything. I don't need to change the world. She's proud of all that I do. But it's like she's the kind of person that could just hang out in one place. You know, she doesn't want five homes. She wants one place to hang out, type of thing. So she's a great balance to me. And also, look, I really have learned over the years in my early 20s and 30s, maybe in my early 40s, I think I was obsessed with how do you achieve more? How do you give more? How do you accomplish more? How do you make more happen? How do you change the world? I'm still driven by those things. But I really believe that to have an extraordinary life, there's two lessons that you got to master. One is the science of achievement. You know, you really have to be in a position where you understand the rules of the game. And if you don't know the rules, you're going to get hurt. And if you know the rules and you learn to maximize them, you can win. There's a science of achievement. And I can't tell you how many people who call me got, multi-billion dollar net worth, and they want me to come, quote, do something for one of their businesses. But when I get there, I uncover what they really are hoping I'm going to do is help them find fulfillment in their life or happiness they think it is, because they don't have it. And they're miserable. And so I really believe the second master lesson of life is the art of fulfillment, because it's an art. It's not a science. You've got to uncover it. You've got to discover what fulfills you. It's different for every person. It's like, art. You know, if you've ever gone to an art show and you see this big red square and you go, how much is this? And the person says, I'll give you a real example. My friend Steve Wynn, he bought this Rothko, right? So it's basically a big red orange square. And he paid $65 million for it. And I said, Steve, it's an orange square. I'll paint one for you right now for $1 million. Not a problem, right? And teasing him. He goes, no, Tony, you've got to understand the history. And only as Steve can do, he can tell you the history of the man's life and where he was and what it's about. And it's extraordinary. So what fulfills one person, another person, kind of smiles at. You know, if you want to know what fulfills God or the universe, go to the jungle. I mean, diversity is what makes life alive. So what makes you fulfilled may be different than the person next to you, but there are two fundamental principles that will guide you to be fulfilled, because I really believe success without fulfillment is the ultimate failure. So whatever fulfills you is what you want to find. And so you look at the principles are simple. You got to grow. If you don't grow, you die. We all know it. The only universal rule in the universe, one of them is you grow or you die. Everything in the universe grows or dies. But, that, by the way, includes your relationship, your economics, your business, your philosophical or spiritual life, all those things got to be growing continuously. You're dying a little bit inside. So I'm driven by that. In fact, I always tell people, you know, in traveling 100 countries around the world, dealing with millions of people, you know, I can tell you there's one word key to happiness: progress. Progress equals happiness, not change. Change is automatic. You can, you do nothing, things are going to change. The world's going to change. The economy's going to change. As the years go by, your body's going to change. Progress is not automatic. Progress requires consciousness. Progress requires you're going to go for it. And if you're not even where you want to be, but you're making progress, you're transforming your body just a little on path to something bigger, if you're on the path to do something to make that relationship better or the business better, you're going to feel alive again. You're going to feel great. So that's one principle. The other principle beyond growth is contribution. And it's universal. There's only so much joy you can hold in yourself. Like, you know, you can feel good pleasure in the body by, you know, getting high or drinking or having great sex or whatever, some great food, some beautiful music, whatever it is. But all of those things have a limit. Most great things we've experienced in our lives, the minute we experience them, we want to share them with somebody we love. And why do we want to do that? Because when you share something, it magnifies it. So I really believe we grow so we have something to give. When those two things happen, you have a magical life. And I'll give you an example of the opposite. I feel like we lost a national treasure about 9 months ago when Robin Williams passed away. I mean, yeah. Did you know Robin by any chance?
I didn't know him personally, but a big fan of his work.
Yeah, well, whenever I go to an audience, I ask people recently in this last few months, I've been saying, how many of you were touched by this man, felt a connection to this man? And all over the world. You know, I was in China, I was in Japan, you know, Australia, Europe, almost everywhere I go, 80, 90% of the room will raise their hand because he made so many movies and things of that nature. And you think about this man's life. I mean, his goal was to be one of the funniest men alive. His goal was to have a TV show. Then his goal, he wrote, was to have the number one TV show. And of course, he did all that. Then he wanted to make movies. Then he wanted to not only make movies, he wanted to win an Academy Award. He wanted to make people laugh all over the world. He wanted to have a beautiful family. He achieved all of that, and he hung himself. I mean, think about that. He hung himself. Yeah. I didn't know him personally, intimately in any way, but you know, I did a TED Talk once, and at dinner, it was my birthday, and he jumped up and, you know, did sung happy birthday to me in front of the restaurant spontaneously as a crazy drunk Russian, as an old woman, and as a Jewish lady, and all in the peace. I'll never forget it. And if I'd known, I've not lost one, what kills me, if I've not lost one suicide out of thousands in 38 years, knock on wood, doesn't mean I won't someday, but we've done follow-up films, so I know why people do it. I had no idea he was in that place and they have a personal connection with him. But when you look at that, was he successful? I'm not marring the man's name, but that's failure. He made everybody happy but himself. So I think it's not about go full tilt or not go full tilt. It's not about, you know, life-work balance. There is no life-work balance. There's life-work integration. If you've got something that's your mission and it feeds you, and you're on fire with it, be on fire. And when it's time to rest, you'll rest. And when you do it too long, the body will make you rest. And I think for me at this stage of my life, I have as much fulfillment as I have achievement. And the combination of the two is really, really a beautiful thing.
You haven't had a suicide of one of your clients, but you know a lot of people who have. You know a ton of high achievers who are depressed. Why does this happen? What are the biggest things that, you know, that they can be doing or that we can learn from what they should be doing?
Well, most people are running their life based on a blueprint that comes from a place that they didn't really create. So I'll give you a simplistic example that maybe will work, maybe it won't, just real quick here. Whose love did you crave most growing up, your mother or your father?
My father.
Okay. And who did you, and by the way, when you say you craved it, it doesn't mean you didn't love the other person. Right. It just means you craved it more. So with your father, who did you have to be for your father?
Who did I have to be? You know, it's interesting. I was going to say my mom first, but she loved me all the time. And my dad did too, but he was more focused on work. He was working a lot as growing up. And I don't know who I had to be, but I wanted to get his attention more. And so maybe better in school, maybe, you know, more impressive.
Yep.
I'm not sure exactly. I don't know. Maybe, this is a therapy session. I'm liking it.
No, it's not therapy. It's just clarification.
Yeah, absolutely.
So trust yourself and just go with your gut. So I needed to be an overachiever. What would the language you'd use? So I'm not using my language. What language would you use?
Let's go with overachiever.
Okay. And what else did you need to be? I needed an overachiever for my father. I needed to be.
I don't know. There was something. You know, I had an older sister who was kind of the darling of his eyes, you know, his first daughter, and it was very clear that she was his favorite, and I was the middle child. She was his favorite kid, yeah. And so I don't know. I needed what she had, a sort of magnetism or charisma. I don't know.
Yes. Well, you say you don't know, but this is what people commonly do. They go, I don't know, and you're telling me what you really do know. Okay. Yeah. But you're wanting not to make the wrong description, and I get that. That's part of human nature. But so let's just take – and who could you never be for your father? And try not to filter just for a second.
I mean, I could never be my sister. I could never be what she was to him.
Yeah. So what does that set up?
You know, obsessiveness, longing for love, like endless going after it.
Yeah. And so that model of the world – how much of that has driven you in your life?
I would say probably a lot. I've been obsessive about achievement ever since I was like 7 years old. I said I was going to make the NBA.
Yeah.
And I always had these big goals. I remember sitting down with my parents. I'm like 13 years old. I'm like, you know, I should have realized that I wasn't going to make the NBA at this point. You know, I'm 5'10", I'm skinny, I'm Jewish. A lot of things working against me. And I just told them I'm going to make it. I always had these bold declarations, and I worked hours a day, and I wanted him to see, I wanted him to come.
Yes.
And he did. He did.
Yes, but he did. But I can hear in your voice though, and by what you said earlier, that you could never be her. So it would never be enough.
Yeah.
And so,
exactly, so
that's part of where your hunger has come from. Here's the beauty of that. You're a hungry man, not a man that was so fulfilled that you didn't have to do squat and you were loved unconditionally like your mom. She filled some of that for you. But if that's all you had, I doubt seriously you and I'd be talking on the phone right now.
Right.
Right? Because you wouldn't have had this desire to figure out answers and to look for things. And when you couldn't do it with the NBA, you shifted to other areas of life. You and I have a lot in common. I wanted to be a professional baseball player because my father, one of them, that's what he was. He was a semi-pro baseball player. And when I didn't make the junior high school team, I got cut at the last moment. I was like, oh my God, if I can't do that, how am I going to make the high school team, go to USC, go to the minor leagues, go to the major leagues? So I decided to become a sports writer and a sportscaster. And I learned to type. I learned to take shorthand so I could do interviews. And I started interviewing Dodgers and Rams when I was in junior high school. And I got a job at a daily newspaper when I was a sophomore in high school. And, you know, I thought that was my path. Channel 11, KTTV. Came to me and gave me an opportunity to be their sportscaster. They tried everything, even Fannie Fox, the stripper, and they go, this guy's getting interviews with some of the biggest players out there. It'll be great. And my mother decided my ego was too big and she wouldn't let me do it, and that career path disappeared. But all that drive came from trying to find a way to have it be enough of what my mother wanted me to be. And it was never enough there either. And so I developed this hunger. So here's the beautiful thing. We both have channeled that hunger into things that serve others and serve ourselves and our families and our friends and people around us. Some people's, you know, convert that hunger into just anger. And that anger is, why was I treated so unjustly? Everyone can take the same experience and create a different model of the world. But in your case, not getting what you wanted, I would argue, and maybe it's bullshit, but I would argue, has served you, even though it didn't feel very good. You know, and it was nice that you had your mother's love as kind of a balance. But your father, he wasn't holding back. He just expressed it in a way that was different. So what I'm saying to you, though, is you're more than that. I'll give you an example. Maybe it'll be helpful to understand. So I have four kids, and they're all adults. And I shouldn't call them kids, but they're still mine, so I guess I get to do that. I love them all completely. They all have unique talents and abilities. I'm incredibly proud of all of them. My youngest boy, I have been concerned about up until about 2 years ago at a very extreme level, meaning – not about him as a human being. I mean, the kid has got a heart of gold. I mean, truly the most giving, loving, contributing kind of kid you can imagine. But he developed early on a different lifestyle than I had. And he grew up where we went on vacation to our own island that we have in our own resort. I mean, I grew up, you know, it's like, you know, can we go get two hot dogs at Wiener Schnitzel because we've got a discount coupon or not? You know, it's a different world. And so I wanted him to earn what he had in his life. But, you know, he grew up in an environment where he had a lot of privileges, and he learned very quickly to be very strategic, and he's very influential. And so I would show up, for example, one of my clients, won't say who, but a very successful rock and roll group, let's say, and my son is already backstage, like, how the F did he get here, right? And I go to him, like, oh, well, he heard he's your son, so we took him here, and he's coming on the road with us. And everybody wants to do me a favor, because they go, you changed my life, and they're doing me no favors with him, because I felt like he had no work ethic. His idea of work ethic was my idea of sleeping, right? And I'm thinking, you know, money's not going to solve it. If I die and he doesn't develop that, he's not going to have the inner pride. And so I was obsessed about it. So here's what's really interesting. In life, when you're born, I feel like you're born with every option, right? You don't have to be a certain way. When you're a baby, you can do anything and you're loved. You know, you crap your pants, you can drool all over the place, you can throw up, you're loved. Your mom's got oxytocin. You look like a lizard. She still thinks you're beautiful. It doesn't matter. She's full of oxytocin. It's God or the universe's way, nature's way of making sure we can survive. Someone's going to take care of us. But eventually that disappears, and we learn we have to do certain things to be significant enough to get that total love and connection. And so we either do something significantly good or significantly bad, right? And some we adapt. We learn. And as the years go by, we decide who we can be and who we can't be. So for your father, who could you never be for your father? You could never be...
my sister.
And I could also never be... I could never be enough. So those pieces inside of you have made you have to straddle your world a little bit and say, okay, I got to be myself, but there are parts of yourself that you're not even aware of. And so here's what I learned over time. That whatever your strength is... your strength is there because you identify so strongly with it. One of my strengths is clearly my work ethic. My, you know, I over-prepare for everything. I want to rip it open. I want to add more value to human and alive. That drive is a great strength. But it's a weakness, too, not one I'd notice. What's the weakness? Well, it can drive you so much, it'll drive you into the ground if you're not careful, right? It'll beat you in the ground. It'll stress your body out. You know, you might not live a long time. And so I started thinking to myself, what if my son, who I'm having these conniptions about, I can help the whole world, but have a hard time helping him, right? Because he doesn't think he needs it. It's, you know, it's conditioned and he's being rewarded for his behavior regularly by all my friends giving him whatever he needs or wants. I thought maybe he's supposed to teach me a lesson. Maybe it's life coming full circle where I'm supposed to claim some part of myself I've disidentified with. And I thought, you know, what is it that he's got that I don't have? If there was a skill that I don't have, what is it? And I immediately came to my mind. I started to laugh. I thought he is the master of chilling. Right? Chilling was not one of my skill sets. And so I called him up and I said, you know, he's an adult now, right? And he was at the time, I think, 28 and or 27. And I said, Jay, I said, come over to the house. I want to talk to you about something. So I could see him arrive at the house, kind of shoulders down, thinking, oh boy, we're going to have one of those father-son talks that I don't like to give and he doesn't like to hear. And I didn't do that at all. I said, you know what? I want to apologize to you. I said, I want to tell you something. I said, I have been so obsessed with wanting to make sure that you're strong and you're resourceful and you're incredible and you're all these things that I said that I've been trying to make you me in some way. I said, I always said I would never do that, but I am at least at the work ethic level. And I said, I just realized I don't want you to be me. You don't want to be me. I want you to be whatever you is. And I want you to have a great quality of life, and I think work ethic is a part of that process, but I'm not going to talk to you about that anymore. You're going to find your way on it. But I thought, maybe I'm so obsessed with this because I'm really supposed to learn something from you. And he looked at me and I said, you have a skill set that I don't have and I want you to teach me. And he looked up and he had that look in his eyes like, is this a technique? You know, I could see his face. And I said, you're a master of chilling and I want to learn to chill. And he started laughing out loud. He goes, Dad, you are not a master of chill. I said, no. So I said, I really want you. He goes, you're serious? I said, I'm dead serious. So he's like, well, you just kind of sit here and he's kind of, I said, that's what you, how the hell do you do that? And we laughed our asses off. And I got to tell you, when I let go of my charge about him having to be a certain way, that charge is a part of myself I disidentified with as a child, that I could just relax and kick back. I wouldn't be, you know, I wouldn't have the love if I was that person. I had to be the overachiever. I had to make everything happen. And so I don't have to chill quite as much as he does. It's not my goal. But it is really added value to my life. And my wife will tell you, it's like, God, my husband can let go now. It's a really cool thing. It's a nice balance to that experience. And what's ironic is, when I no longer have the charge in that area, my son's work ethic exploded. He just recently got married. He's driven as can be. He's found his stride. Now, would I say he's driven like I am, like a crazy animal? No. But is he driven enough to have an extraordinary life? Absolutely. So I think sometimes, you know, I don't sleep, I don't eat. My wife loves to sleep. You know, she can sleep 8 hours and still be happy to have another cat nap. I go much beyond 4.5, 5 hours, and it's like, man, I'll sleep when I die. You know, she wants to eat. She's got low blood sugar. You know, I go a day or two without eating, not even notice it because I'm so into what I'm doing. But what happened is it used to drive me crazy, but as I want to make that good for her and I reclaim some sleep for me, it balanced my life. So we all have imbalances that come from blueprints that we think are us when really they're our reaction to the love that we craved.
Yeah.
Most people either become that person or they reject that person, or thirdly, they give up and don't know what the hell to do because they feel they'll never succeed. You didn't give up. You found ways of finding ways to fulfill your passion and your drive. And I think it's a beautiful thing and I honor you, Eric.
Thank you. It's interesting. Channeling this hunger to achieve and accomplish what you're talking about full circle with the people in your book who you've studied. And how do you channel that hunger into, you know, still being super hungry to achieve and accomplish so you can give more, but also to you know, contribute, as you say, and also have a quality of life in other areas like your body or your, you know, your primary relationship or...
To me, it all comes down to everything in your life is you're driven by decisions, right? I mean, I tell people it's your decisions. It's not your conditions that shape your destiny. And if you really look at it, we all could look back and see something we did, a decision we made 10, 20 years ago, that if you made a different decision, your whole life would be totally different. Sometimes it was a big decision, it was a little decision, like where are you going to go to school? Who are you going to date? Which leads to who do you marry? Which leads to who are your kids? I mean, there's so many decisions. So I look at it and say, all decision-making is value clarification. And you got to know what's most important to you, and you got to update it, because otherwise you're just going to be running an old program, some old software. Most of us wouldn't use a phone from 5 years ago. What the hell are you doing using a blueprint of the world, a set of values from 20 years ago, unless you've updated them, and they're really what you believe is right today. So I'm real clear. To me, the most important thing in life besides my mission is my family, period. And my wife is the top of the list. And, you know, my kids know they're totally loved, but I made it really clear to them. It's like, I want you to see what a loving relationship looks like. And if we don't model that, it's not going to happen. So I don't let them, you know, in any way subdivide. And my wife's family had a very similar thing. She grew up with, you know, 8 children, and some of them were adopted as well. And her mom and dad is like, we're number one, you're number two. And right. None of them felt less loved. Whereas today, most families put their kid first above the relationship, and then they wonder why the relationship destroys and then why the kid can't have a great relationship later on. I really believe the quality of relationships is the quality of your life. And your intimate relationship is where that starts. If you don't have that, be fully alive. I don't give a shit how much money you've made or how much you've achieved, how many accolades or trophies you've got or Grammys or, you know, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. I deal with people like that all the time. So I know that. And then on the body, you know, I'm stronger today physically than when I was 26 years old. I can lift more. I can run faster. I won't be able to do that forever, but I'm going to extend that as long as I can, because I know without my body, without my emotions, without my relationship, all the rest of the stuff is a waste of time.
Yeah, and to your relationship point, it's amazing that, you know, the intimacy with our partner or most intimate relationships really, you know, judges so much of our happiness, and yet there's very little education or you know, on it.
Making a relationship work is easy. I mean, all you have to do is have enough in common and you can stick together for 25 years. But you know, I want passion, love and passion. If you got love, it's a beautiful thing. It's certainly better than no love. But why would you settle? You know, if you two people, you know, they have passion in the beginning, it doesn't go away because you've been around each other. I've been interviewed people that have been together. Remember, a man was 92 and the woman was 89. They came to my seminar and they always made it to the front row. They fought me in the front row in these big events. And they were like all over each other physically. It was like almost the point of like, get a room. So at one point, rather than be annoyed, I reached out to them. I brought them on stage and I interviewed them. And I remember asking them, I said, you know, how do you guys, I mean, you guys seem to really be passionate for each other. And they said, yes. And then, you know, the woman said, I said, what are your secrets? And she said, well, she said, the first thing we learned, you got to touch all the time. And he laughed, right? And she goes, but also it's really important to try different things. I said, yeah, how long have you been together? And they were together, I think, 60 something years. And I said, and it's, you still find it new? I mean, intimacy is still new. She said, oh, yeah. And I said, what's your secret? And she piped up again. She goes, we have a simple rule. We try anything once, and if it works, we do it again. She laughed like hell. The whole room was cracking up, you know? So I just think you can't, we're sensual beings. If you cut off that part, that sensual sexual part of your spirit and your body, they're all tied together. You're not going to feel fully alive. And the reason people drift apart is because, you know, it's not men are for Mars and women are for Venus. It's not like men are one way and women are another. But masculine energy is one way and feminine energy is another. We both have both those energies. We have to know which one's primary in us, and we have to honor what's primary and utilize both sides of ourselves, not limit ourselves. But when you lose polarity with someone, you know, what makes a relationship work, things in common. What makes a relationship passionate is differences. It's having those different energies of masculine and feminine energy. And when both of you get masculine or both of you get feminine, the energy dies. It's like, you know, there's a positive and negative pole. There's North Pole and South Pole. There's put on a plug in, there's two different elements there. And that's what creates the electricity. Well, that happens in a relationship also. So in my relationship early on, I learned how, you know, most relationships I really believe don't die for lack of love. They die for a lack of intimacy. And then intimacy is gone because you're depolarized. You're both feminine. The man is now trying to please all the time, or the woman is now hard as nails, and the man's hard as nails. I mean, when you have that, the most thing you're going to have, is, if you're lucky, is a friendship. You're sure is not going to have intimacy. So I do a whole 6-day event on this. We take couples and do some pretty extraordinary work. It's one of my deepest passions.
Yeah. The lack of intimacy in the relationship, you know, is the real problem, but we mask it with all these other problems.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's like eating. You know, when people overeat, it's not hard to figure out. They're emotionally disturbed at some level. They're emotionally unfulfilled. So rather than deal with that, we just keep eating. And we live in a world where 75% of the United States, or 70%, excuse me, now are considered overweight. And the fastest growing group is morbidly obese, right? Over 100 pounds overweight. It's insane. We're the fattest country in the history of the world. And it's not because it's so complex to figure out how to be fit and strong. It's because most of us are busy stuffing down and we're not dealing with what's really going on inside of us, because our world just keeps accelerating and people get distracted. I mean, and we live in a social media world where people are constantly figuring out what to communicate, you know, to somebody else about their life rather than doing it. You watch people and their kids out there and they're all taking pictures and sending a tweet. They're not even actually there with their damn kid. It's just the stupidest thing I've ever seen. And, you know, we've thrown our pendulum and it probably isn't as extreme as it's going to get. But I think at some point it'll balance itself out, because it's not a very fulfilling life. It fulfills your needs for variety. It fulfills your need for something unique and new and maybe feeling significant. But, oh my God, do you really need to filter every picture of your life and share it with every human on earth? I mean, does anybody really give a shit? Most people's lives, most people are not fit. Most people are not happy and fulfilled in their life. Most people do not have an intimate relationship filled with passion. Most people do not love their work. I'm not deluded. Most people don't have those things. Most people are not successful in their own business. 96% fail in the first 10 years. 4% make it. And that doesn't mean they're profitable. But very few succeed. But there are a few who do. And I'm obsessed with finding the few who do and showing people who are interested how to do that. And you got to be a little more than interested. You got to be hungry and driven. Because interest won't get you there. Interest will open the door. And maybe that interest can grow into hunger and passion. And if it does, then you can have an extraordinary life. Otherwise, you're going to settle like everybody else. And if I can help it, and I can be a trigger for someone, both to show them the strategies to close the gap between where they are and where they want to be, or to experience more fulfillment, more joy, then I want to do that. But I don't have the delusion that everyone is going to look for that or want that, nor is my path the right way for everybody. I'm a crazy, passionate guy. Talks 100 miles an hour because I'm on fire for life, and I'll do this up to the edge when I die. I want to die, you know, climbing the mountain, not sliding back. That's just the way I am, and that's not right for everybody. But for people that are hungry or driven, or become hungry or driven, or want to be in an environment of hungry, driven people, I provide something that most people probably have never even imagined.
So what would you tell your 25-year-old self? Or how would you think about building a life for yourself?
I would say, you know, the most important lesson of life in any generation, it never goes away, is to have a meaningful life. It's got to be about something more than yourself. If all you're striving for is to achieve what you want, you're going to have a very shallow life and a very unhappy life. You know, it'll feel good for the moment. It's like mental candy. You get it. You feel high for the moment. It'll go away. But if you can find something that you want to serve greater than yourself, and it's something that you can feel so much hunger for that you're pulled to it, you're not having to push yourself, then you've found the greatest gift, and you've got to do whatever it takes to get exposed to enough people, experiences, adventures of life to find what turns you on. And once you find it, grab a hold of it and never let it go. I'd say the second thing is that to have that extraordinary life, the most important principle I learned from my original teacher, Jim Rohn, he taught me early on. He said, Tony, find a way to do more for others than anybody else. I was already doing it, so it appealed to everything in my soul, but it was like I never forgot. You know, find a way to add more value, and the world is yours. I mean, because most people settle. And if you're a person who never settles and you never settle, you know, you're not just trying to meet your needs, but really you get addicted to lighting other people up, meeting their needs, then you're going to have an unbelievable life, because you're going to have deep relationships, not shallow ones, and you're going to have an unbelievable amount of growth in your life. And if you're in business and you add value, you're going to do incredibly well economically if you're constantly finding a way to add value. Not the way you want to add value, the way your people need the value. And I'd say a third thing I'd probably say is work harder on yourself than anything else. Certainly harder on yourself than you do your job. You know, you've got, in order for you to give more, you have to be more. And it's like, if you want things to change, you got to change them. If you want to be better, things to be better, you got to get better. There is no other path. There's no free lunch. So, and last thing I'd probably say, thinking out loud, is proximity is power. Something I didn't know early in my life, I understand today.
Can you elaborate?
Yeah, I was on a trip when I was in my early 30s, and I went with this group of just brilliant guys, and one of the guys, the richest man in Canada, and you know, Pat Riley, you know, one of the greatest NBA coaches of all time, just a really who's who boys trip, and they were all 15, 18 years my senior, and I got invited on this trip. Just, it was a wonderful gift. And I remember I felt a little out of place, and at one point, the richest guy in the group, it was his Gulfstreamer on, I'll never forget, he sat down next to me, and he said to me, he said, "You piss me off." I said, "Excuse me?" I'm like, "Holy shit." And I'm already feeling like I'm not enough. I'm pissed off the number one guy on the trip. So I said, "Excuse me? You piss me off?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Everywhere we go, we've gone to Vietnam and Cambodia and China. Because everywhere we go, you know, wherever we go, people go, Tony, I love Tony, but, you know, they can't even speak English. And I love Tony. They want to hug you. They want to take a picture with you." He goes, you know, I'm the richest man in Canada. You know how many jobs I create? You know, no one has ever walked up to me and looked me in the face and said, you know, you changed my life. And what he really did was he felt what I was feeling. It was brilliant. He felt like I was feeling like an outsider. And he goes, "How old are you?" And I think I was 30. I was about to turn 31, I think. He says, you know, when I was 30, I'd earned $1 million and I lost it and I was broke. He goes, "I want to give to be your age and have what you have in your life." And he said, "I get the sense that, you know, you think you're out of place here." I said, "Well, you know, I'm not in your league." He said, you're looking at life in the wrong way. He said, "You're looking at the year instead of the decades." He said, "Trust me, if you keep growing like you're growing and doing what you're doing and helping people you're helping," he goes, "and you have any focus at all on the future, you will be able to do anything you want in your life." And then he said something to me. He said, "But you do need one piece of advice." He goes, "Tell me what you really want to do." And at that stage of my life, I always grew up thinking, you know, I want to have the most impact I can. And when I was 17, I went to Jim Rohn's seminars. I thought, how can I change the most lives? I'll be president of the United States. That's what you think when you're a kid. So I was like, okay, here's my plan. I'll be student body president. I'm not the most popular kid, but if I can do it for real on real issues and win, then I'll do state assembly. And then I'll go, you know, run for the Congress and then the Senate. And then I'll do it. By that time, I'll do it on my own dollars. That was my whole game plan. And I said, you know, it didn't work out quite that way, but I said, long term, I said, I think I've got a certain amount of skill and I'd love to use that bully pulpit, but I'd want to do it on my own terms with my own capital and maybe a few other people. So I'm not answering somebody else. I've worked with a couple of presidents and quite frankly, it's disgusting what I see. I'd only do it on my terms. And he said to me, Tony, he goes, "Then you have to remember one thing. Proximity is power." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Let me ask you a question. How many investment bankers do you know?" I said, "No, I don't know. No, they've been to my events. I mean, I don't know. Probably a couple dozen." He goes, "How many do you spend time with?" I said, "None." He said, "That has to change." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You need to get around these investment bankers because if you're just in proximity with them, something's going to happen because you're an amazing force of energy and opportunity, and they will see that, and they'll want to do something with you, and it'll just happen." He goes, "Look, if you wanted to make a movie right now, you could make a movie in 2 seconds flat." Because before I made Shallow How, I was already in like 15, 18 films in my 30s because all these people in the movie business, actors, heads of studios, agencies, I don't know why, but I have a massively disproportionate number of clients in that area. They're raving fans. And so they put my stuff in. They, you know, say, "Hey, is it okay if I do that?" And they'd say, "Sure." He said, "If you want to make a movie right now, all you need is a decent script. And you're in these environments. They want to do this with you. You could do it tomorrow. But if you want to do a deal with IBM, you'd be screwed. I'm not saying you couldn't do it, but it'd be really hard." He said, "Proximity is the ultimate power." He said, "You should get around these investment bankers." And I said, "Yeah, but I don't like to do that unless I have a plan and I can do something for them. I'm not a taker. I'm a giver." You know, that was one of my obsessions in my blueprint, right? "I don't have a plan yet. I don't even give them." He said, "Tony, it'll be a giving to spend time with you. They'll want to spend time with you. Trust me." So I did it. I started going there. And then the good news is I became part of this group. So 3 or 4 months later, I saw him again. He goes, "How's it going?" I said, "Well, I had several meetings." "How many several?" I said, "Six." He said, six. In 3 months, he goes, "That's not massive action. What the hell's the matter with you?" And he kicked my ass really good. And so I spent the next 3 years flying to New York, going to have these meetings, meeting people, having conversations, networking shit I don't like to do. You know, I want to do something of value to somebody. But then one day I get a phone call and somebody needed something done. And I said, "Listen, I can do that for you." And they said, "How much are you going to charge me?" And I said, "Nothing. Let me just show you I can do it." And they said, "Well, how many months will it take?" I said, "I'll do it in a day." They had this company and they want to merge these two guys, two companies, public companies. And these guys hated each other and no one could pull it off and they're going to lose the deal. And I said, "I'll do it in a day." And they said, "That's, what are you?" I said, "Listen, I'm sounding bold or I'm sounding arrogant. I'm not. Just watch. I'll do it in a day and I don't want anything for it." But I said, if you want me to do more after that, I'll do more for some stock." So I went in and put the guys together. They made the deal. The company went public. And these guys were out of their minds. So they said, "Well, would you integrate the teams?" And so I integrated the teams and I got stock in the company. And in a month and a half, the stock was worth $30 million. I'd never made $30 million in a year at that point.
Wow.
So I was like, wow. And then that grew to another deal that I did that eventually was worth $400 million, you know. And so my life grew because of proximity is power in economics, but it also is true spiritually. And I spent a ton of time traveling the world, and I love to meet heads of all religions. And in India, I meet people of every walk of life there. And the evolution that's happened in my life by that proximity, you know, it's cool to have my monk friends and my, you know, hedge fund friends. It's just a diverse life, and it makes life rich, you know, at all levels. So I really think who you spend time with is who you become. And you've got to deliberately put yourself in the environment. So I think you got to decide what you want and put yourself in proximity of what you want if you really want to be successful long-term at any level. You put yourself in proximity of people that are really happy, and you're going to find that happiness will start to rub off on you. If you put yourself around people that are really successful and miserable, you're going to be successful and miserable most likely, because unconsciously we become like those people. Even if you have a higher standard than someone else, if they're your friend, you know, if you play tennis against somebody that plays the game at a lower level than you do, your skills are not going up, they're going down. If you get on the field with somebody that's so much better, you're playing against Serena Williams, you know, just to stay on the court with her, your skill set's going to go up. So I've spent my life trying to find people playing the game at a higher level than I am and getting on the court with them and then becoming qualified at some point to be their friend because I have equal ability or skill at some point.
And let me ask this, and I think about this for myself as we've gotten more notable and my life has changed, obviously nothing too much, but just enough to know the difference, the balance between private and public, as you become, you know, a much more public person and now, you know, a super public figure, is there ever times where, you know, you're talking to your family and your partner is like, hey, okay, enough Tony Robbins for now, let's just hang out, or, you know, knowing when to put kind of the ego aside or performingness aside. What do you think about that, or how have you thought about that?
Well, I'm certainly not a movie star, but I have a different kind of stopping. People stop me to share with me these amazing stories, which I truly love hearing, or they stop me and they want advice to change their life now. They don't just want a picture. My, you know, movie friends and music friends, entertainers, you know, somebody's excited to see them, and that it's over in a second. You know, so mine are a little more intense and more in depth. Right. And that's not always convenient, but I have a simple discipline. I would have died to have these people coming up to me when I was in my early 20s. So I never, ever, ever, and I challenge you to find anybody in my life who will say that I really didn't give them the focus. I might not have a lot of time, but I give them the focus. And I don't just give them the focus. I really appreciate and let them know I appreciate them stopping or asking or sharing with me. My wife is a very private person. So the fact that people want to know what you've had for breakfast, you know, what size shoe you have, what you're doing, you know, that, you know, you get stalkers and people that come and, you know, they think they're supposed to marry me, even though I've been married for 15 years and all that crazy shit. That's annoying for my family. But, you know, I try to do my best to create a structure of security and protection as far as that's concerned. And on the other side, my family understands that this is part of the mission of what we're doing. They're really proud of it, you know. So, you know, we're going to sit down at dinner and you say, look, you know, 100 million people are going to eat while we're eating because we found a way to add value to a mass number of people's lives. And we took some of the profitability of that and we found a way to give some people some hope. That's a pretty cool thing. You know, I've got 100,000 people a day I provide fresh water to in India, where the number one killer of children there is polluted water. You know, it's waterborne diseases. And my goal is to get that up to 1 million people a day. I mean, that excites the hell out of me. And my family is excited about that too. So it isn't always easy for them, but they're completely supportive, and I have a real simple standard that says that's just how it is. Now, if somebody is abusive or mean to my family, that's another thing. That, and then you cross the line. But outside of that, no, I'm grateful for the privilege of being able to serve.
Last cue, and then we'll get to plugs. Do we ever get over our need to satisfy our parents?
Oh, some people do. I when you say satisfy them, it's one thing, please versus satisfy. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I think for me, all four of my fathers and my mother, so five, and both my original parents are all have passed. And I think when I realized my blueprint was driven by my mother, that I had to be an overachiever, that I had to always be kind, I had to be nice, I had to be good. You know, I went through a stage of rejection and said, fuck that. You know, it's like, you know, I am a good person. I am a nice person, but I'm also, I get pissed off and I'm tired of this shit, you know? And I think I went through a place where I reclaimed other parts of myself. And when I did, it kind of let go of all the pieces of, I got to please my mother. Is it enough? I don't know. I hit my threshold. And that was while she was still alive, which is a great thing. And so when she's passed, I don't have any regrets. I think some people will let go and some people won't. I think the answer is, do you come up with a blueprint of your life that you've designed? Or are you still running theirs? I'm very grateful for the hunger that came out of the pain of my childhood. But I'm even more grateful for the hunger that comes today, that comes out of playing the game at a higher level and being able to give and enjoy and grow and expand, which is a healthier hunger. One ignited me, and the other one continues to feed me. One was not sustainable. The one I'm on now is sustainable. And so it's not driven by my mother or my father or anybody else. It's life on my terms. And that's, if there's a gift I try to give people when I work with them, is I help them uncover, you know, I give you a little two-second set of questions, but I go much deeper. Uncover what really is making their world the way it is, the beliefs and values and rules that control every thought, every feeling, every emotion of your life. I do a program called Date with Destiny, and I take people and 6 days and have them do that. And if I have a friend, I'll go do this for 5 hours with them sometimes. And then when they understand what it is, I have them now, they on their terms wire their life so that they're naturally pulled to what they want, not what their history wants. And that's a sense of freedom that is beyond words and is magnificent and allows you a level of comfort. You know, I always say, you know someone's spiritual development, not by what cross they wear or insignia they wear, or how often they go to church, but how comfortable are they in their own skin? I mean, if you could be comfortable with who you are and you feel this connection and desire to serve something bigger than yourself, you've got a pretty magnificent life.
Yeah,
there are very, very few people that I've met that have that, and the ones that do are incredible role models.
Right. It's that tension between you know, always wanting to grow and get better and improve and give more, but also being comfortable in your own skin.
Correct.
Who's had it in your life or that you've seen that you really admire?
Well, it's interesting. I say Nelson Mandela is one of the most incredible human beings I ever met. The level of comfort had his own skin and yet still completely driven to make life better. I made a mistake. You know, I asked him, I said, please share with me, how did you survive those, whatever it was, 26 years, 27 years, whatever it was, 25 years. And he, you know, he's a big man and I'm 6'7". He's a big guy. And he rose up in that moment. He had this horrible look on his face. I'm like, what did I say? And he looked at me in the eyes and said, I didn't survive. I prepared. And I thought to myself, holy shit, you know, this is amazing. And he said, he told me about it. He was in jail and he was thinking, I'm either going to die in jail and my death is going to start a revolution, or I'm going to live. And if I live, I want to be prepared, you know, to lead. And so that's why he studied Afrikaans, so he could speak in the language of those individuals. So he would be an extraordinary example of that. But I would say the people I just described, you know, Mark, Steve, Peter, another one would be my dear friend, Paul Tudor Jones. They're all people that have that incredible connection to something larger than themselves, and yet they're still driven. They don't need to do anything, and they're not doing it because they have to. They do it because it's part of who they are and it's expression of their gifts and of being alive, and that's a beautiful thing.
Tony, thank you for giving your time to our entrepreneur audience today. They're going to absolutely love this. The book is Money, Master the Game, 7 Simple Steps to Financial Freedom. Where can people find you on the internet and learn more about your classes and offerings?
They just go to TonyRobbins.com. Or they can go to my blog, which is TonyRobbins.com/, I believe, blog. But we can get there through TonyRobbins.com. And I hope it's been helpful. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but hopefully some perspectives. I've found that when I listen to something, I'm listening for one insight, one distinction out of every interview I hear. And usually if I find one and act upon it, it enhances my life. So my prayer is that they found something useful out of this. And I really thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. If people do take one thing from this, make sure to tweet us. We want to know. Have you ever tried to freestyle rap or rap in your life?
No, I haven't, but it would be a blasphemy because I'm old school. I still love Tupac. I was listening actually last night to a version of him with Elton John, believe it or not. I never heard before.
No way. It's
wild, really wild combination between those two.
Well, if you or friends ever want a session or a lesson, let me know.